Hello and welcome into the Who's On Podcast, part of the Sabre Podcast Network. We've got another episode of the Who's On Podcast coming to you this week. A little bit different today. I'm going to set this up a little differently. Obviously, we're a UVA-focused podcast, but today I want to talk a little bit about the state of college football in Virginia. And to do that, I've got Editor-in-Chief for Seaville right now, Mike Barber. You've been around the state for a long time, Mike. So happy to have you on yet again. How's it going today?
Really good. And yeah, it's a nice way to say that I'm getting old. But yes, I've been all around the Commonwealth.
Who's not though? I mean, we're all getting up there.
Yeah, and I would say it beats the alternative. So let's do it.
There you go. Real quick, I know you were at the press conference yesterday with Tony Elliott, so I do want to get into a couple updates ahead of the Stanford game, since obviously we do cover Virginia on this podcast. So let's get to them first. Cam Robinson is back. Obviously, that's the big news. It's been the expected timeline of progression ever since he had that fractured collarbone during fall camp. He's practicing this week. He is expected to play this week. He warmed up last week as a little tease for everyone, as Tony Elliott and his crew have liked to do. They like to get guys out there to warm up a week ahead of when they're actually expected to return to play. How big is this for Virginia, just having number five back on the field?
Yeah, Preston, I think it's absolutely massive. I mean, if you think about the way they struggled, especially run defense against NC State, I know they dominated William & Mary. I know they dominated Coastal Carolina, and that's not totally disparaging those results, but a lot of that had to do with the opponent. I think NC State is more in line with what you'll see from Stanford, and they struggled. They struggled to control Hollywood Smothers. They struggled to control, gaps, and I think Cam Robinson fixes a number of those problems. Number one, he's a great run-stopping linebacker. He's explosive. He can come up and he can go downhill and make those plays. Number two, he's a mistake eraser. So if a guy is in the wrong assignment, in the wrong gap, if a guy breaks a tackle, he's able to get over there and make that play still and turn, a 6 and 7 yard gain, keep it at that as opposed to it going long. So I think Cam Robinson is kind of just what the doctor ordered for what we saw go wrong defensively against NC State.
You mentioned Hollywood Smothers. Micah Ford coming in this week as the reigning ACC running back of the week. He had a great game against Boston College last week for Stanford. So couldn't really have asked for better timing as far as, all right, we got to corral another running back. Let's get number five back out there. And I love the quote from Chandler Morris yesterday. Like, you realize when number five is out there just on the practice field, like he makes a presence out there. So obviously he's been missed. Other injury notes, the unfortunate one, Noah Vaughn, it looks like a high ankle sprain. I know Tony Elliott said they're still looking at some more tests for him, but I mean, gosh, the guy has his breakout game, goes over 100 yards, his first time in his career, and has that injury. Wallace Unamba probably out till the bye week, according to Tony Elliott. He's been week to week until then, and it looks like it might be a little bit longer for him. Daniel Sparks should be available to punt with a hip flexor, but probably not going to be on kickoffs. And obviously, I think he's going to hold for Will Bettridge, which is kind of the underrated part of his duties out there. And then the other big one is Antonio Clary should be turned loose. Those are the words of Tony Elliott. He also had caution with Antonio Clary. That's an interesting one, because I think overall, the safety play has been pretty solid so far between Devin Neal and Ethan Minter. But what could Antonio Clary, I guess, add to this defense, even if it's a smaller role than what we're used to?
Yeah, and I followed up when he said turn loose. I asked him about, and it does sound like, we're talking about maybe a few plays going to get him back into the swing of things this weekend. From what I heard, turn loose, that sounded like he's ready to go, start every snap. And but look, we saw it last year with Clary, right? He came back and then got re-injured, and nobody wants to see that again. He brings, one, a really defensive presence in the back end. And two, Antonio Clary is a really good football player. Like, I think everybody's been caught up for 2.5 years now in his battle to overcome injury and how valuable he is as a leader and what a great dude he is. I ran into him yesterday. He was getting ready to shoot the uniform reveal photos. And so all that's true. He's also a really good football player, and especially, again, talking about run stopping, talking about coming up and supporting in that area, I think he could be really valuable. But again, you don't want to bring him back, have him play three snaps, and have another injury.
Yeah, Antonio Clary and Drake Metcalf in that video this week. I don't want to give it away. They like to have fun with their uniform reveal videos, so I won't give it away what they're wearing. We'll see it then. Predictions for this one. UVA opened at 16.5 point favorite. They're down to 15.5 point favorite in this one against Stanford. Stanford has to do the reverse of what Boston College had to do last week with going all the way out to the West Coast. Now they got to come all the way to the East Coast. And over time, we've just seen that that has a little bit more of an effect. You know, that's a couple points right there in the the gambling portion of it. But what do you predict for this one?
Yeah, I'm actually surprised the line is where it is. Stanford
It's
impressed me
high.
against Boston College. Yeah, I think Virginia wins this game. I think Virginia wins this game by a touchdown. But I thought, 15, 16 points that we were seeing popping up, it just seems like a lot. And look, I could be wrong. I think Virginia is the better football team here. You mentioned the travel. I think that adds to it, certainly. But that's a big, big spread, especially for a Stanford team that is able to run the football and control the. You're not going to run away from Stanford in part because of the way they play. There's just not enough clock there for you to go ahead and pile things up. So I think Virginia wins, by 6, 7 points, but that's a generous spread that right now you're seeing from Vegas.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time Virginia had a spread that high for a Power Four opponent. It had to have been for a while. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think there's a couple things. It's a home game in the travel. I think that's like Vegas adds a couple extra points when you got those two factors in there. But yeah, I would expect probably a little bit closer than the 15 and a half. So I wouldn't. I'd probably take Stanford on the other side of that, but still expect Virginia to win probably comfortably. It probably maybe looks a little closer in the end, I would say. All right. The reason I had you on today is, obviously a lot of news in Blacksburg last week. And I think Virginia fans, after they finished up watching William and Mary and Virginia at Scott Stadium, they all went home and turned on ACC Network last weekend to watch Old Dominion and Virginia Tech. I think, as far as what I've seen on our message board, they probably enjoyed that later game more than they even enjoyed the Virginia home game that they watched earlier in the day, where Virginia set school records. But I kind of want to take a bigger picture look at the state of college football in Virginia right now, because obviously these two programs are linked so closely together now. Even so, like the last two coaching hires Virginia and Virginia Tech have had to made both came in the same years, 2016 when Bronco Mendenhall and Justin Fuente got hired, and then 2021 when Tony Elliott and Brent Pry got hired. And it's interesting just to watch, because the pair, you get to watch these programs at the same time and kind of the direction they're heading. Virginia Tech has won more in that span, including a 9-1 record against Virginia over that span. And they've been to six bowl games compared to Virginia's three bowl games over those 10 years. So I guess just where do you kind of see things right now between these two kind of pillars of college football in the state?
Yeah, it's really interesting situation because if you think about it, you can argue, hey, Bronco Mendenhall proved to be a better hire than Justin Fuente, even though at the time I thought Bronco was this weird out of left field hire and Fuente was a home run, right? I was just wrong, right? Those two played out the opposite way. Now you look at Tony Elliott, Steve, he's still going, and this season it will determine a lot about Tony Elliott's tenure at Virginia. But Brent Pry did not work out. I thought Brent Pry was a good hire at Virginia Tech. So when you're looking at the athletic directors and their track record, you put that one in Carla Williams' column. I know people are not always pleased with Carla and the number of important coaches that have left Virginia, but in the football hire department, she's winning there. I think it's what we've seen is Virginia realize it was falling behind faster than Virginia Tech realized it was falling behind. They both fell behind. I think they both did things that can be very easily criticized. Should be criticized that allowed their programs to fall behind, not even the SEC Big Ten, but the rest of the ACC. I think that's where the problem for both of these programs was. And I think Virginia just kind of corrected course a little bit more quickly than Virginia Tech did. You heard it in the announcement of replacing Pry and everything that's going on. They're going to look at the whole department. They didn't say these words, but they appear moving towards the pro model and a GM. You need that. And they were slow to that. And so I think you're looking at two programs that right now Virginia's got a little bit of a leg up in terms of it's further into the process of remaking itself. Virginia Tech's got a leg up in that it's got a more passionate fan base and a better, tradition and history on the football side. The race between these two is always going to be fascinating. But I think what was kind of a bummer here in the Commonwealth was they were both racing for the back of the pack, and they need to get back to that middle and that top.
It's interesting that I guess we get the slight edge to Carla here in the coaching hires, and obviously Virginia fans would have qualms about, Tony Elliott thus far, and obviously he's off to a decent start this year in year four. But Justin Fuente is the only coach of these guys with a winning record. Obviously, he benefited from some players that he inherited, and a good start for him there at Virginia Tech. Why do you think? Obviously Virginia Tech has the better record over this time span, but why do you think Virginia Tech has kind of fallen behind? Even though, and like you said, I liked both the Justin Fuente hire and the Brent Pry hire. I see a lot of people chiming in, it's like, I never liked the hire. And I'm like, I mean, could you really say that at the time? I mean, like, I loved Fuente as a guy that was a proven, offensive guru coming up to Virginia Tech. And obviously what that program lacked for a couple of years there at late in Frank Beamer's tenure was offensive ingenuity. And then with Brent Pry, it was like a get back to the culture kind of hire. And I like that too. And, neither hire worked out. And I don't think that's necessarily entirely on the hire.
Right, and I think that's the point here. I think Justin Fuente could have worked. I think Brent Pry could have worked. I think it's other forces at play here that Virginia Tech has to correct. Or guess what? The next hire isn't going to work either. And I think they are moving in that direction. Look, I thought Justin Fuente on the field was a pretty good X's and O's football coach. I thought he struggled with recruiting, with fan base, with some of those other engagement areas. And that's why Justin didn't work out. And again, levels of support, things behind the scenes. But I thought that was sort of his crux that he bore. And then if you look at Brent Pry, I think Brent's great with recruiting. I think Brent's great engaging the fan base. I think a lot of being the salesman of the program is right in his wheelhouse. I think he struggled on Saturdays, man. Like they're not good in close games. He started out calling the plays for the defense. I thought that hurt him from a game management standpoint. I think going with largely unproven coordinators. As a first-time head coach, he really needed, look, I think he needed a Phil Montgomery, who he has now, or he had now until he lost the job. Phil's now the interim coach. That would have been a great place to start with an offensive coordinator. I just think as a first-time head coach, there were some missteps there that led to execution issues on Saturday. And then look, the Old Dominion game, nail in the coffin, but an example of everything that's wrong. Whit Babcock, Brent Pry, they went before the Board of Visitors at Virginia Tech and said, we don't have the resources to compete with the SEC, with the Big Ten, and with a lot of ACC teams. So getting beat by Carolina, South Carolina, and getting beat by Vanderbilt, that actually helps your argument. Like, look, I told you. But when you get hammered by Old Dominion, who has a smaller budget, who has less than you do, that tells me there's a problem with what you're doing on the field. And that is ultimately, I think, what cost Brent Pry his job.
I don't want to leave out the other programs in the state because obviously, I mean, the other three have been probably more successful to a certain extent over the last decade or so. You've seen Old Dominion, not a ton of success, but they've had the three upsets over Virginia Tech, including the bookends to Brent Pry's tenure there at Virginia Tech. Obviously, they beat him in his first game, they beat him in his last game. JMU, 28-9. Heading into this season, since making the move up to the FBS, they obviously beat Virginia a couple seasons ago. And then Liberty, they have the 2023 Fiesta Bowl on their record there. So, I mean, kind of the sport of college football has, it's not just those guys anymore. And we can t the recruiting part of this is out, is different. And a lot of people are like, oh, well, they've got these other FBS programs in the state now. And it's like, yeah, but they're not really a ton of Virginia talent on those teams. Like a lot of the Virginia talent is going to Penn State. It's going to Clemson, South Carolina, Shane Beamer, and it's leaving the state entirely. But those other three, kind of lower a group of five programs in the state have done really well for themselves.
Yeah, and I think, they're coming from a different place, right? I think JMU's the gold standard there and
Yes.
maybe in the Commonwealth at this point, but their arc and their path was completely different. It was building up to this point, and JMU did a phenomenal job of doing that. Whereas Virginia and Virginia Tech were at a certain level in terms of funding resources, the way they run your athletic department. And now they've had to almost reinvent the wheel. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. Like, I think Tech and UVA were slow to do that. Whereas JMU, they didn't have the wheel necessarily, right? So they were kind of, and they were building to this point. they've done a tremendous job of getting to that point, and I think it's why now they're ahead of the game, because this has been the arc they're on. Whereas, it's always harder, I think, to recover from a dip. And if you're Virginia Tech or UVA, when we're talking about behind the scenes, how you support your programs, I think they're both in dips. And again, I think Virginia is a year ahead of recovering, and I think Virginia Tech is just now saying, "Hey, this isn't something we can kind of slog our way through. We need to reinvent the wheel."
Let's focus in a little bit on Virginia Tech here and just kind of the sequence of events here. Obviously, you lose that game against Old Dominion. First 0-3 start for the Hokies since Frank Beamer's first season all the way back in 1987. They fire Brent Pry pretty quickly the next day, and a move that I don't think has surprised anyone. But it is shocking to have a Power Four job open up in mid-September, let alone two, because you have UCLA in there as well. Open up within minutes of each other. So I don't know the betting odds of who had first coach fired, who wins that in the end, because both those guys let, get out there. You mentioned the Whit Babcock, the athletic director there, met with the Board of Visitors back in August 18th, saying that Virginia Tech needed $200 million as an operating budget to compete at the top of the ACC, currently around $122 million. Board of Visitors planning to present a plan on September 30th, their plan to further support athletics financially, leadership-wise, organizationally. And then I think the interesting thing too is, you get this firing of Brent Pry. It's Tim Sands, the president of Virginia Tech, that makes the announcement. Whit Babcock is now part of the decision, but like he's talking to the committee that's going to be making this decision ultimately. It's an interesting situation there. And he talked about the need for a general manager moving to more of a pro model going forward. This timeline over the last 2 months or so, it seems like it's all kind of built upon each other to get to this point.
Yeah, and I think ultimately it would have been maybe a little less jarring if they could have gone 6-6 and made the move in the off season and then talked about, restructuring. This becomes more not punitive, but like a panic, like a reaction, like, okay, this is how, but you're right. This was coming, I think, either way. It's interesting the way they framed what's going to happen with the search committee. I think Whit Babcock has done a lot of really good things at Virginia Tech, and I think Tim Sands doesn't want to part with Whit Babcock, but I think he also knows that the boosters may burn down Lane Stadium if they let him hire a third coach after the track record he's had. So I think this is a way to kind of split the difference and say, look, we're going to move into this pro model. We're going to have somebody who oversees football, and Whit Babcock is still the guy to lead our fundraising and lead our Olympic sports and lead our athletic department as a whole. I think a lot of people expected Brent and Whit to go together. And this may be the path by which, Whit Babcock kind of saves his job. But the timing is fascinating, right? And especially in the NIL era, 3 games in, all of these kids can go in the portal and preserve their year.
Yeah.
That was a concern. I heard people who say, even if you decide to fire him, you've got to wait till after the fifth game so that you don't have a mass exodus. I think Virginia Tech did the right thing for a number of reasons. Number one, you mentioned DeShaun Foster at UCLA. Those are not going to be the final coaching changes of this offseason.
No.
You want that head start. And look, I mean, I think a lot of people in Blacksburg have their eyes on Charlottesville. And are they going to be competing with Virginia for a coach? I think people in Virginia and in Charlottesville are rooting for Tony Elliott to have a good year and to keep that thing going and keep their advantage. But I think if you're in Blacksburg, you'd be naive not to think, hey man, we might be competing with a UVA program for a coach. Let's get ourselves out there. Let's get rolling. So overall, there are pluses and minuses to the timing. There's culture differences. I know I work here with Luke Neer, and Luke hates when I bring up culture, as an overblown kind of term. But I think UVA has a culture of they don't want to make a change in season, and I think Virginia Tech was okay making this move now, even though there are some drawbacks, some advantages. Ultimately, I think that, this process needed to start probably 3 years ago, in terms of rebuilding everything. And this is a violent shove towards doing that right now.
Yeah, I think, and we've mentioned it several times, but both athletic departments in Virginia and Virginia Tech were behind the eight ball with all this movement and everything. And maybe Virginia was just a year earlier to react, as far as, kind of the resources needed, the NIL money, and it helps when you get a big anonymous donation to come in there, but also just the structure. Virginia's put in, this pro model led by Tyler Jones, the general manager there, who's, over football, but also has his hand in a couple other sports as well. And it kind of frees Carla up a little bit to like let Tyler kind of handle that, day-to-day general manager type stuff, and kind of be the long-term vision guy for the roster. And it looks like that's what most of college football just needs to move towards, because it's too much now for one athletic director to kind of be all over everything.
Yeah, and look, we're using the term, violent shove. Going 0-3 and losing Old Dominion is a violent shove. I think in some ways, Bronco Mendenhall walking away was the violent shove for UVA, right? And maybe I'm not saying that that, was a good thing or that that was the design, but I think that moment forced UVA to look at some things differently. I think this moment forces Virginia Tech to look at some things differently. I think both of them would have benefited doing it sooner, but again, maybe an unintended positive impact of the timing with Bronco was, hey, some things had to change, and I think it put them on this path.
Looking at this job right now, and I've listed out some of the candidates that keep coming up. Who knows? I think one thing that we know for this program going forward, you can pretty much, and I don't want to say 100%, throw out any candidate that doesn't have proven head coaching experience. I just think that there's no way that you can go that direction now. And that's kind of the way that all these hires go. Is like you hire the offensive guy, then you go hire the defensive guy, or you hire the guy that has proven head coach experience, and then you go hire the up and coming coordinator. Like you flip flop back and forth, based off of, oh, well, that didn't work. Let's try the complete opposite way. Maybe that's not the greatest way to look at it, but that's kind of how these hires go.
Yeah, and I think every hire informs the previous hire. Like that's the real way to look at it. So I think what you want now is to hire a Justin Fuente who also has a better resume when it comes to recruiting and fan engagement. So you're just learning about each job is a little bit different, right? At Tech, you need somebody selling that program out front, doing the things that Brent Pry was doing. But you can't afford a guy who can't coach on game day, a guy who's going to lose all those close games. You're not going to have the advantage you once had talent-wise. So you're going to have to win some games with scheme. All that said, think about that resume I just laid out, Preston. Like, who doesn't want that coach who's an experienced winner and great executing on game day and a good, like, so now it's can you find that guy and does that guy want you, right? Like, I mean, you're going to need somebody who aligns with everywhere you're going with this new direction for the athletic department. And look, I've seen some names like people, everybody's gonna talk about Shane Beamer. I don't know why Shane Beamer would go into that crucible. He's at a great spot. He's got connections. South Carolina wasn't a random job for Shane. I think it's where him and Emily, where him and his wife met. And I mean, it makes sense for him to be there. I think that's a pie in the sky kind of wish. And then you look at like the coach at Tulane, John Summerall. Like, I think everyone at Tech thinks that's a great fit, but I think a lot of people in the country look at John and think that's a great fit. So the competition you're going to have for that hire, that's where it gets complicated. Then you start looking around and you say, well, what about Ricky Ronnie? It's Ricky Ronnie beaten Virginia Tech a number of times that has us in this conversation. Do you look at Ricky Ronnie? Do you look at Bob Chesney at James Madison, who is another one of those kind of up-and-comers, proven record? Bob checks a lot of the boxes we just said in terms of being great out in front of the program, being a salesman for the program, proven winner on game day. There's going to be some pride swallowing if you're a Tech fan to go either of those two routes to say, okay, one of these little brothers from in-state, they're ready to lead our program. But I think Bob Chesney's profile is what you're looking for. And if you could maybe find that somewhere else, great. But it's going to be a really interesting hire. Again, depending what happens around the ACC, even at UVA, what is the competition like? It's going to be a fascinating job market.
And the Bob Chesney one is interesting. He's only been at JMU for 2 years now, but he's been a head coach for a long time. He's kind of been one of those guys that he worked his way up as a head coach rather than like as a position coach, the coordinator and stuff. But he's been good in that short period there at JMU. Throughout some a couple other names, we cover the Shane Beamer part of this. John Summerall, it seems like he's probably going to be a pretty big popular hire for SEC programs that are looking to move on after this season. So a couple other ones that we can throw out there. Do we want to talk about Michael Vick real quick, just to kind of push that one to the side? He's in his first couple games at Norfolk State. And I feel like this could be one that comes back in the future, but it just seems way too soon right now.
I think Michael Vick, if he was inheriting a successful program, would be a fascinating hire at Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
If Frank Beamer had retired and gave way to Michael Vick, it could have been a really interesting. I don't think you can gamble on that.
Yeah.
This hire can't be a gamble, especially if Whit Babcock's still part of it. Like, this has to be a successful hire. Not saying that Michael wouldn't be, but you can't gamble on somebody who doesn't have the track record. Again, I think you need somebody with years of coaching experience. Look, people are going to mention Kurt Cignetti, right, at Indiana.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that's likely or reasonable. I mean, he's got the money, he's got the success.
Financially, yeah.
I just think that, Kurt's in a good place. But again, maybe that's the kind of profile. A lot of people would say, like, somebody like that is too old. But I think at this point, you need a stabilizer. You need somebody who's going to come in and make you good and relevant for 4 or 5 years. And then maybe 4 or 5 years from now, we are talking about a Michael Vick or somebody like that, when you've reestablished what this program is.
That brings up some of the power four, I guess I'll call them retreads here. Dan Mullen, who's at UNLV right now, Pat Fitzgerald, the former Northwestern coach, Jimbo Fisher, the now ACC Network talking analyst, who was at Texas A&M, of course, Florida State. All those guys are kind of interesting because they have won in the power four level. They each have their own drawbacks. You can look at Dan Mullen, and his recruiting track record is not great. And yes, you can go and pull up that he had the number 10 class at Florida, but that is almost the worst class that Florida has had, because how do you not recruit well at Florida? You can look at Jimbo Fisher and all the talent that he had at Texas A&M. Looks like the recruiting part of it was great, and obviously he had some financial help with that, but never really showed on the field. And outside of a couple years at Florida State there, didn't really show a lot there either, and they kind of ran him out by the end of it. They're like, fine, here's the door. Pat Fitzgerald, obviously, he just settled a lawsuit with Northwestern. He's an interesting one though, because he kind of fits that Virginia Tech culture. I can hear Luke like screaming in the background there, but he kind of fits that culture element for Virginia Tech. But those three guys are three ones that keep getting thrown out there as well.
Yeah, I think Pat has almost a Bud Foster feel to him, like it, and maybe even less than Bud, but like more of Bud's players, like this sort of scrappy underdog, tough nosed kind of. So it is intriguing.
What's hilarious is I'm trying to go back to watch the 1995 Virginia Florida State game, because obviously the 30th anniversary is coming up, and I was watching the broadcast and they included the pregame show. And I'm watching it, and they're talking about, I think it was like Penn State Northwestern or something, and there's Pat Fitzgerald as a linebacker, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, he is like prototypical like Big Ten 90s linebacker.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, that's what Bud built that defense on, was
Yeah.
those, except a lot of them were walk-ons too. I think Jimbo Fisher is a fascinating candidate to me. Again, there's parts of it that fit really well. There are parts of it that don't fit really well. Again, we're talking about two head coaches being fired in week three. There may be some names that we're not even talking about
For
who
sure.
become available in terms of the retread department in week five, week six. And now if you're Virginia Tech, you're further along in the process of like being ready to make that move. It's going to be really interesting. I think ultimately what you're going to see at Virginia Tech is an experienced head coach with either a tremendous offensive pedigree or a very good relationship with a experienced offensive coordinator. I think you're going to see a break from the Frank Beamer line, right? Like I don't think the fan base wants another, like, Justin Fuente honored and kept Bud on the staff and honored Frank's legacy and all, and that was great at the time. And Brent Pry was a throwback to that. I think the fan base this time wants to see a clean break. So I think you're going to see an experienced head coach with either an offensive pedigree and or a connection to an offensive coordinator who's up and coming, kind of a star in the field. And I don't think you're going to see it come from the traditional Blacksburg coaching lines. I think you're going to see it come from somewhere afar.
I do want to mention the Dan Mullen one interests me so much because of reasons that really aren't about him as a coach, but does he decide to bring his quarterback from UNLV with him to Blacksburg, who I don't know if anyone's heard of before, but his name is Anthony Calandria. That's just a beside the point. But last thing I want to get into here is, where does this put UVA? Because currently, I think everyone kind of just wants this to work. With Tony Elliott, they want to finish a good season here. They put all this resources. The administration wants it to work. I would say most of the fan base probably wants it to work. They don't want to go through another bad season and go through all this again. So I think that currently the track is this works this year, and we kind of continue to build. But this is a huge moment for them because I mentioned before the last couple coaching searches. Same exact time Virginia Tech was going through their coaching search. So they were always restarting at the same time as Tech. Now, if they could kind of have some continuity, we're talking about, the financial commitment, recruiting. I mean, the Cavaliers are already in on several Hokies decommits, the few that they had before, Brent Pry was fired. And then, you got to talk about the future appeal of, to the SEC or Big Ten whenever this conference realignment happens in 2030 or beyond.
Yeah, I think, this is a chance for Virginia to gain an advantage. It's also tremendous pressure, even more so on Virginia, because if you're getting into week eight and you're 4-4, now there's almost more pressure to, should you do something? Do you need to keep up with the Joneses? Look, the best case scenario for Virginia is to have a good year and to let Tony Elliott keep building. And I think that is the schools that are really successful, they're able to do that. They're able to get through those in-between years. But certainly, knowing that Virginia Tech is making a change, knowing that they're going to be in the market, you don't want to end up not making your decision until week 12. And now you've given up 9, 10 weeks of advantage to Virginia Tech and their plan. Again, though, Virginia is ahead in terms of the infrastructure and some of those things. I think this puts more pressure on Virginia. And I think it doesn't change the storyline of Tony Elliott needs to win. And that puts Virginia in the best place going forward.
Yeah, ideally you want just this season to work out with Tony Elliott. But I think it's going to ask more questions if things do not go well down the stretch for Virginia. And I'm going to say too, puts even more of a big emphasis on, November in Charlottesville against Virginia Tech. We saw a couple years ago, 2021, J.C. Price and his cigar came into Scott Stadium and as an interim coach and beat Bronco Mendenhall. And that was the last time we saw Bronco Mendenhall, donning the UVA apparel as he walked off the field there. I think just from what I've seen, a lot of Virginia fans are very cognizant that this doesn't make it any easier for Virginia. Like they have to win this game now. There is so much pressure on them. Whereas Virginia Tech, it's almost like, whatever, you're playing with house money now. Like if you do well, you do well. Like if you don't, like who cares? The season's over.
Yeah, I mean, from a story standpoint, it was sort of a bummer that J.C. Price didn't get the interim tag at Tech, and just like Ricky Ronnie started and ended, Brent's tenure, what would it have been if J.C. Price kind of officially started and ended things for Tony Elliott? But again, we talked about they don't want to go old school throwback. That's why J.C. Price wasn't going to be the guy this time around. That game's going to be fascinating. It always is. But again, if you're talking from the Virginia perspective, now you feel like if you go into that game with 7 victories, 6 victories, 7 victories, and you can get a win, it really does feel like a launching point for this program. Whereas if you go into that game with 5 victories or 6 victories and you lose it and a change comes, it feels like everybody's starting all over again. And look, starting over is hard to do, even in the portal era where you can do it more quickly. Starting over is hard to do. That's not the path you want to chart if you're Virginia.
Yeah, for sure. Just what do you think the rest of the season looks like for Virginia Tech as far as, transfer portal impact? We mentioned it earlier. Guys can jump into the portal. I've only seen one so far, and that's the cornerback Dante Lovett. Doesn't mean others can't because you got 4 games. You could make an evaluation after the Wofford game if you wanted to. So that they have this week. What do you think the rest of the season looks like for the Hokies?
It's fascinating, and something that we may never know, but I'd love to know is, are some of these NIL deals, like, how are they worded? We're saying, okay, by NCAA eligibility, you can still go in the portal, But what do you give up financially in terms of the deal you signed? And there isn't a lot of transparency right now on those deals. I'd be fascinated to get an athlete who would essentially come out and say, hey, I was considering the portal, but if I stay through this date, I get this amount of money. And I think that's going to be at play here.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see what Virginia Tech can hold together. I don't have high hopes for what this season's going to look like. I think timing-wise, again, we talk about the fact that Wofford's coming in. Maybe you can get back some momentum. I'm going to be interested to see what the fans' reaction is, right? I
Sure.
think a lot of fans wanted a change. A lot of fans wanted to move on from Brent Pry. Now you've got a game coming up. It's easy to say interim coach, 0-3, Wofford coming to town. Nobody's going to show up. But if I'm a Tech fan and that fan base has shown up through thick and thin, I show up on Saturday. I say, this is what I asked for. I asked for you to make a change. Now I'm going to be here in the stands to support the program for the remaining, 9 weeks because you gave me what I want. I think that might be what we see. And not that it's going to be a sellout, again, Wofford, new, like all that. But I think you're going to see the fans rally behind the team. It's just a question of, the team didn't show a lot of fight against Old Dominion. They kind of got going late when I almost like realized they were being embarrassed.
Yeah.
It will be really interesting and telling, not this game, but the next couple to see what this team's going to do. And there's a tough stretch coming up for Virginia Tech on their schedule. That also is a kind of tipping point where things could potentially get ugly in Blacksburg.
On the flip side, real quick, do you think this invigorates Virginia fans into being like, all right, this is our shot. Like, let's go take it. Let's get behind the team. And, obviously they've looked pretty good so far this season. Obviously, you could say what you want about Coastal Carolina and William & Mary, but they took care of business, which is something that Virginia has not always done in those types of games. And, NC State, I think that depending on the season goes, I say, like, if they end the season well, then you forget about it. If you don't end the season well, that's one that you really regret in the long run. But do you think this kind of, gives a little more juice for Virginia fans to be like, all right, let's have a good season?
It should, but I feel like I've said that 100 times and they don't answer the bell. But look, it's
Yeah.
playing Stanford, ACC opener at night. Your program is going better than your rival's program. All of those are reasons that the fans should turn out. They should turn out. And if things are going well, they should stay. Like, I mean, we've seen that in William & Mary and Coastal where like things couldn't be going better for your team. And like the students all leave at halftime.
Yeah.
And a lot of the fans trickle out. And I'm like, that I don't get. Like, hey, if you're getting your butt whooped, I get it. Like, I don't want to sit in the stands and watch my team get just demolished. But when you're winning, that's like a big old celebration. I think they should draw well against Stanford. I think they should get excited. And again, it's ultimately up to Tony Elliott and the team to build on that and to keep that excitement moving.
I think we can agree this season just got the importance level just rose up another level. If it was already high for Tony Elliott and the rest of the coaching staff, but now it's gone up a level. All right, Mike Barber, you can see all his stuff on Seaville right now. Anything you got coming up you want to plug real quick?
We got an interesting story I think fans are going to want to check out today about espionage in college football and how it relates to UVA. So I think that'll be a little shameless plug there for SevilleRightNow.com. That's coming out in the afternoon.
All right, he is the chief, Mike Barber, over at Seville right now. That'll do for the Who's On podcast. Thanks again for tuning in. Remember to like, subscribe, everything on YouTube, our new YouTube channel, Who's On Podcast. We're picking up a lot of subscribers there and a lot of views. So I would really love to keep that momentum going as we kind of get further into the season. And as always, you can leave a 5-star review on Apple. Really helps people find the podcast. And also, it's nice to hear some what you're liking about the podcast. And also like, subscribe, follow everything that you do on Apple, Spotify. Thanks again for listening. That is it for the Who's On podcast. We will be back with you later next week after the Stanford game. Stay tuned.